Vadis USA, der Podcast des Heidelberg Center for American Studies. Hello and welcome to a new edition of the HCA podcast, coming to you from Heidelberg University. My name is Anja Schüler. We will be talking about deserts today, which for many of us are mythic spaces or maybe just empty wastelands. Deserts, however, can also be crucial political spaces and sites of imperial aspirations. That is the argument put forward in Arid Empire, The Entangled Fate of Arizona and Arabia, a book by Natalie Koch that is hot off the press this month. Natalie Koch is a professor at the Institute for Geography here at Heidelberg University, and she is my guest on the HCA podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
So before we delve into your book, please tell our audience a little more about yourself. You have just started your tenure as a professor for human geography here at Heidelberg University at the beginning of this past winter semester. What is the focus of your work as a geographer?
Yeah, thanks. So I'm primarily identifying as a political geographer, but I guess in the broader sense, human geography as well. And most of my research focuses on bigger questions of geopolitics, identity politics, the state system, as well as I would sort of say a major focus on authoritarianism. And empirically, most of my research is centered in the Arabian Peninsula now, although previously I was working in Central Asia. And I think just kind of coming out of much of my research on authoritarianism that has forced to, after living in the United States during the Trump presidency, and even I would say before, forced me to look much more closely at American society and American power structures. And I got really interested in U.S. connections with other parts of the world and U.S. relationships with other authoritarian systems. So in the broadest sense, much of my research is looking at questions of empire and authoritarianism together.
Now, I just mentioned in the introduction that your new book, Arid Empire, is just out. What prompted you to look at the entangled fates of Arizona and Arabia, as you call them in the subtitle?
Yeah, so I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and I always sort of understood my personal identity as connected with the desert of Arizona, of southern Arizona. I hadn't really ever considered looking at politics within the state myself, and so I started traveling and doing research in different deserts of Central Asia, as well as then later the Arabian Peninsula. And I was always sort of filtering those fieldwork experiences in the international sense through my understanding of, yeah, what desert, the significance, the political and practical significance of deserts were in a place like Arizona. So I always had that perspective in mind, but I never really thought to interrogate those exact connections. Then in 2014, right, 2015, I heard the first news story about this Saudi Arabian company that had purchased a farm in Arizona. And my immediate reaction at that time was, because I had grown up in Arizona, I thought, oh, okay, I remember hearing about these wasteful agricultural practices like growing cotton, and that this was something that people were trying to stop. And I hadn't really gone back and looked at those questions of what was happening with agriculture in the state at the time. So I was totally shocked that a Saudi farm would be something still happening in 2015 in Arizona. And so that was kind of the first spark of my interest in looking at these connections, and then it just spiraled. So I work in the Arabian Peninsula. I work in Oman, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. And in all of these places, I just kept finding more and more connections with Arizona as I started to actually look at that, at those connections. But really, it's not something that you would necessarily just be aware of as a general person. But I think because I had already been specializing in Gulf studies and was from Arizona, this is what led me down the rabbit hole of trying to uncover all of these connections between the places.
So Arid Empire is sort of the overarching concept that connects the parts of your book. Can you elaborate a little bit on that concept?
Sure, yeah. So I think the place to start with this concept is actually with the history of when the United States acquired these vast desert landscapes, because I think many Americans and many people in general tend to forget about how recent the territorial expansion of the United States actually was. So it wasn't until the 1848 Mexican-American War that huge swath of territory of what we now think of as California, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, all of these desert places in the U.S. Southwest today, they were added at that time. But the challenge for a lot of the early settlers and colonialists in the United States was that they didn't know anything about the desert per se. So they had established the U.S. as a state and as a country on the East Coast, where there were just very different practical questions. So from quite early on, the people who were put in charge of taking over this territory, and specifically the Department of War, was one of the major forces in this. They had to figure out how to physically, reach distant parts of the territory and how to set up army outposts, et cetera, et cetera. So they really, really struggled with this quite early on. And so the general challenge of how to colonize this land is essentially where my book and the bigger questions about this start. So I think one of the things that many people know about the colonial history of the United States is that there were a lot of people who were informed by Christian identities, Christian values, this whole sort of biblical logic. But this also was brought into how the settlers were thinking about deserts. So for many people, they knew nothing practically of the desert, but they had all of these imaginaries about the desert from those sort of tales within the Bible. And so for those who were then thinking about how to take over this new world desert, they immediately started to think about the old world deserts from that sort of biblical, that biblical recollection. So as these people were, like, people within the U.S. government and different branches of the effort to colonize the territory, they immediately started to look to the Middle East as a way to then help develop this project of taking over the land. So they started importing lots of things: animals, plants, different types of water and irrigation projects, etc. So that's the kind of domestic Arid Empire that I start with, because, as I said, I'm primarily a Gulf Studies scholar. A lot of people talk about U.S. empire in the Arabian Peninsula, but they talk about it almost exclusively around war or oil. And the point I want to make in the book is that actually this is a much longer project, and that U.S. empire that goes and starts to become present in the Arabian Peninsula, it's built on those same networks and those same logics of the sort of Arid Empire in the U.S. Southwest. So I'm trying in the book to tell the story about how you have that domestic empire project that then sort of morphs and becomes a project of international imperialism, of U.S. empire in the Middle East.
So I think the processes that you have just described in your book, you call them desert to desert learning. And the examples you give in your book really intrigued me as a historian. For example, you just mentioned it in passing, the infatuation of the U.S. military with camels as a means for transportation in the American desert, in this land that the United States acquired and didn't quite know, you know, how to handle it. So they brought in camels from the Middle East. This was before the Civil War in the 19th century. And another example that, you know, I would like to talk about is the 1942 American agricultural mission to Saudi Arabia, which, as we can learn in your book, was a goodwill mission during World War II. So there's an exchange of desert knowledge, desert-to-desert learning. And what kind of desert knowledge did Americans import from the Middle East, and what kind of knowledge did they, amazingly enough, export there? Maybe you can give some examples.
Yeah, sure. So the camels are a great first example of that. I won't go into too much depth on this, but they it's really just a fascinating project where Jefferson Davis, who was the Secretary of War at that time in the 1850s, he got sold on this idea of bringing in camels to help with setting up military outposts in the desert Southwest, and thought that this would be a much more efficient way of establishing that military presence. The project was sort of abandoned when the Civil War started, but it lived on in a lot of ways, in the sense that the camels were seen as a really great example of how you could take that that idea of just a different species that we didn't have in North America, and bringing that to help with the U.S. colonial project. I think a lot of the book really talks about, different agricultural connections, because of course an arid zone. The major question in any arid landscape is a question of water, and with that, then there's a lovely quote from a scholar that I often think about, and she writes that colonialism is, after all, an agricultural affair. And really, this was a major challenge, just in terms of food production, but also how to get white settlers to come to live in the U.S. Southwest. But here again, if you don't know how to farm in a desert, how are you going to figure that out? And this was where then a number of different actors, including from the University of Arizona, which is a major part of the book's study, the University of Arizona gets really involved in helping to set up an agricultural experiment station, helping local farmers learn how to farm in the desert, and importing different plants and different varieties of plants like date palms to help establish commercial agricultural processes in Arizona. They very quickly excel at this in a way, because they're also able to engineer lots of new waterworks by, of course, taking indigenous water that was stolen from the indigenous tribes in the U.S. Southwest, but harnessing that through a lot of technological innovations, and groundwater pumping became an important part of that. So by mastering that sort of desert farming and mastering the control of these water landscapes, they started to, various actors from the University of Arizona, but also others that were supported by the U.S. State Department, to send that expertise back over to the Middle East. So you mentioned the 1942 agricultural mission to Saudi Arabia. This is really interesting. There's one particular figure who's kind of a key player in all of this. Carl Twitchell was his name, and most people just sort of remember him as this, as this royal advisor. He became an advisor to the Saudi kings back in when he first went to the Arabian Peninsula in the 1920s. But he had actually lived in Arizona before his first trips to the Arabian Peninsula. And he saw very early on in his relationships with the Saudi kings that he could use that story of this is how we do it, or how they do it in the U.S. Southwest, and selling that to the king as if there was a kind of special expertise. Twitchell was very much an entrepreneur. And he then did a really good job of selling that interest and that insider knowledge of what the Saudi kings were interested in to the State Department. So this was in mostly this was unfolding in the 1940s. And of course, at that time, the U.S. government was really interested in, essentially, they were interested in Saudi Arabia for its airfields. They wanted to be able to land planes in Saudi Arabia, and the king did not want that. So Twitchell got in the middle of this and started saying, the king has this obsession with this farm of his, and why don't we try to build this goodwill by helping him develop this farm? And so he's able to get the State Department behind a number of these projects. And even at this point, even in the Saudi case, re-exporting a number of date varieties that were originally taken from the Arabian Peninsula, quote-unquote perfected in the U.S. Southwest, and then returned to that farm project there in Saudi Arabia that Twitchell gets the U.S. State Department to start supporting. This continues through a huge series of projects, including from the University of Arizona in the United Arab Emirates, what is today the United Arab Emirates, even before it became independent. So in 1968, when the British were still technically the imperial power present there, but they were already being enlisted to develop a big agriculture project in Abu Dhabi. And it's just kind of this repeating pattern that I noticed in the research, where desert farming and special expertise and managing water in the desert becomes a key way that these people from Arizona position themselves as experts who have something to sell back to the Arabian Peninsula, and it really just continues to today.
But you mentioned it earlier in the podcast, the oil industry. I mean, the sort of this import of knowledge into Arabia really does remind one of, you know, what was happening in the oil industry in the first half of the 20th century.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think this is one of the things that's so fascinating about this, is that a lot of these projects, they kind of get tacked onto an interest in oil. So the U.S. government, for example, they were not interested in supporting Saudi agriculture, but they were interested in creating opportunities to, if you're searching for water by drilling wells, you could also be searching for oil, right?
You could find oil.
exactly. And so it was a way of kind of, softening this very narrow interest that they had, as well as then the military side. So in looking at some of these agriculture projects, you see how they then become this special space for those negotiations. And this the U.S. government was doing this from very early on in the region. And I think even the UAE project that I just mentioned is fascinating, because, as I said, it started in 1968. It was the Trucial States were part of the British the British Empire at that point in time. We often just think as if, you know, once the British pulled out in 1971, then it sort of transitioned to a different American Empire. But that process became started much earlier. And again, this idea that it's coming in through something more innocuous, less threatening, by we're just supporting this this agriculture project, which was of course always much more than that.
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating story, but I would like to fast forward a little bit and maybe talk about yet another chapter of your book, the one dedicated to science projects in the desert, especially Biosphere 2, that many of us remember explored how mankind might meet an ecologic catastrophe. But to those of our listeners that are not quite that familiar with that project, can you explain to us what Biosphere 2 is or was, and how projects like it relate to your concept of Arid Empire?
Yeah, sure. So I should first say, I don't remember if this ended up in the book or not, but I visited Biosphere the first time when I was 7 years old. My father took us to see this site. So this is really a sort of burned in my memory. So Biosphere 2 is essentially this big complex just outside of Tucson, which is my hometown. And the idea of it was to replicate Biosphere 1, i.e. Earth. And the idea was to recreate the conditions of a closed system, like Biosphere 1 is a closed system. We don't get anything inside from outside. We sustain ourselves on Earth. So Biosphere 2 was just supposed to be a miniature of this. Practically speaking, though, it was just an oversized greenhouse, and it was representing all these different biomes on the planet, and they were supposed to have a self-sustaining closed environment. So the other part of this oversized greenhouse project was that they were going to run these human trials. And they ran two of these human trials in the 1990s, locking in this team of eight people for, I think the first project ran for just under 2 years, locking them in and not allowing them to take any resources from outside. And it was supposed to just test the ability to live in this controlled system. So when I went when I was seven, that was during the first human trial project. And I remember just looking inside at these people that were locked in. And I just found it so bizarre. I certainly didn't understand it at the time. So it was fascinating to kind of excavate that history for the book. And frankly, I tried to avoid it as I was doing this research, because I knew that it was very closed, very secretive, and massively corrupt. And I didn't think that I was going to get too much information on it. I did. But in short, the sort of closed nature of it was because it was always a sensational type of project, and it was run by these several people, one of whom was a cult leader. He had his own sort of cult in New Mexico before then coming in to run the Biosphere project, and several of those cult members were brought in as the first Biospherians who were locked in that first human experiment. So the idea of this project was really just it was a scam. They weren't really locked in a closed system. They had secret food. There was oxygen pumped in, all these things. But it was this big spectacle of preparing for this kind of environmental collapse that we need to just engineer our way out of this crisis. And as the guys behind the project, John Allen in particular, talk about it, their goal was to show how humans could evolve off Earth. And Biosphere 2 was supposed to be this advertisement for how they could technologically achieve that. But as I said, it was more or less a scam. The other important part about this and how it connects to Empire is that it's very much built on this idea of the white settlers' vision of apocalypse here. And this is a little bit harder to read sometimes, but many Indigenous scholars, especially Indigenous geographers and others, have really emphasized how the ways that we talk about environmental apocalypse today ignore the fact that for many Indigenous people, the people whose land and resources, water, etc., were stolen with the colonization of North America, that was the apocalypse for them. And so in these kinds of spectacular scientific projects in the desert, it tends to erase that violence of colonialism and the fact that this colonial system is also built on intense resource extraction, which has gotten us to the point of environmental problems and climate catastrophe, et cetera. So I think what's really fascinating actually then about the present, what's happening at Biosphere 2 now, there's lots in the middle of what I've just described, but I'll leave that out for now. But now they're hosting a lot of these efforts to develop scientific projects for colonizing Mars, which is pretty logical in a lot of ways. But in, you see this in a lot of these, the discussions about Mars and preparation for the environmental apocalypse on Earth, of just getting ready. It's as if people think about it as Planet B. Of course, many of us are trying to say there is no Planet B. But that's the general, that's the general way that Mars is being talked about. And so colonial vision of just extract until there's collapse, and we'll just find Planet B, Mars,
and then leave.
Exactly. And of course, it's only the privileged who get to leave. And you see this very clearly with that sort of billionaire space race. But it's those same people that are using those same tropes of the desert and Mars is this blank slate, and we can just all solve all of our problems by engineering our way out of the crisis if we can just make it to Mars.
Yes. And of course, and there is this school of thought that thinks we can engineer our way out of the climate crisis.
Mm, yeah.
By,
exactly.
I don't know, putting away, carbon dioxide beneath the surface of the Earth or something like that. Yeah, as I said, it's really fascinating. But to wind down our conversation, I would really like to return to the big picture once more, because as I said before, I'm a historian, and I was just absolutely intrigued by what I learned from your book about desert-to-desert learning and desert diplomacy, and that both reaches back almost two centuries. And then, of course, there are some real implications for that history for today. Most notably, the fact you mentioned earlier that in the worst drought Arizona has seen in the past century, a substantial amount of its groundwater is going to Saudi Arabia's largest dairy. If you wonder how that can happen, it happens via alfalfa grown in Arizona. So what can you tell us about that? And what implication does this have for Arizona agriculture, and U.S.-Saudi relations?
Yeah, so the Saudi example is just a fascinating one, and the project, as I said, got sparked by this interest. And what I originally thought was that I was going to just focus on the contemporary connections, and then I discovered in doing this research that in fact it had this much deeper history. So I've struggled in some ways to figure out how to explain that this history matters in a number of ways, but the fact is that both Arizona and Saudi Arabia have had an incredibly unsustainable approach to agriculture. And that approach has been built on essentially just depleting its groundwater reserves. And this kind of approach, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, I keep thinking about this in the way that the Saudi energy minister recently talked about how they were never going to stop drilling for oil, that they were going to drill to the last drop. This attitude is what prevails in Saudi and in Arizona about its groundwater. They're just going to drill till the last drop. There's been a lot of reporting about this Saudi farm in Arizona in the past year in particular, where they've investigative reporters at the Arizona Republic and other sources have found that there was a lot of potentially illegal terms that were given to the Saudi company Almarai that is owning this farm and sending its alfalfa back to those Saudi cows. Fortunately, if we can say that, in some way, in the elections last year in 2022, the Arizona voted for a new attorney general and a new governor. So Chris Mays is the new attorney general. Katie Hobbs is the new governor. They are both Democrats, and they both took office in January. They have already gotten, they built their campaigns on this groundwater issue and very vocally saying they were going to try to kick out the Saudis, which In some ways, I mean, they've already taken action on that since coming into office just a couple of weeks ago. So it is great to see that in some ways. The point that I've been trying to make within the Arizona media and elsewhere is that it's not sufficient to just kick out the Saudis. That this becomes a really convenient sort of political talking point. But the fact is, Arizona's groundwater laws are completely broken because they're built on this logic of just a drill to the last drop. So I hope that in a lot of ways they start to think about this more broadly. The other point that I have sort of struggled to do research on, and I want to do much more on this in the future, is that I think there's a lot more connections between the United States and the Arabian Peninsula related to water, which is not just about food. It's about the inconvenient things that the U.S. often does not want to look at, which is its military and defense machine. Which is, I mean, the U.S. is very much a garrison state. So many places are dependent on the industry. So my hometown of Tucson is home to Raytheon missiles, and Raytheon missiles and defense is. It's the branch of this engineering giant which makes a lot of missiles, and those missiles are getting sent to Saudi Arabia. The New York Times had a fantastic report tracking the trajectory of these missiles being developed in Arizona and sent to Saudi Arabia, which are then being used in the war in Yemen. So some of these questions, I think, are really uncomfortable for politicians in Arizona to address. But Raytheon uses a lot of Arizona water, too. So why are we so anxious about sending alfalfa to the Saudi cows when we're also sending missiles to Saudi Arabia, which are being used in war in Yemen? So I think some of these questions about the military and defense establishment within Arizona are incredibly important to consider. And it also brings us back to that longer history of how U.S.-Saudi relations have been built on these ties to military questions.
Entangled fates indeed, on so many levels. Thank you so much for these insights, Natalie Koch from Heidelberg University's Institute for Geography. And we had a fascinating conversation about Arid Empire, the entangled fates of Arizona and Arabia. And I will say that this book is a great read. I truly enjoyed it. And Natalie, we will continue this conversation on February 2nd, when we will welcome you and a number of guests to discuss Arid Empire here at the HCA. And if you would like to join us, please check our website for details. So I will see you next week, Natalie, and thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you again for the invitation. It's wonderful.
And that wraps up the current episode of Quo Vadis USA. My name is Anja Schüler. Our podcast is produced at Heidelberg University with support from the Jacob Goldstroman Foundation. As always, I would like to thank Elena Brandao-Mekka for technical support, and I would like to thank you for listening. In the next episode, I will be talking to Soledad Alvarez-Valesco from the University of Illinois at Chicago about the dynamics of migration from Latin America to the United States, and especially the movement of unaccompanied and undocumented children. So stay tuned, and please stay healthy.